gravitational collapse and black holes. We're still basically studying the Schwarzschild geometry, but there's a bit of a preface to this topic. And the idea comes that what we were talking about with the Schwarzschild geometry was the space-time outside of a spherical star. Now, the evolution of stars is one of the central topics in astrophysics, and it turns out that gravity is a central player in all of that physics, and it has nothing to do with general relativity. So I won't talk about it in any detail then. But what you probably know is that what you end up with out there in the universe is gas floating around. Gravitational forces bring that gas together. It starts to collapse. When it does that, you get a lot of kinetic energy. And you get so much kinetic energy that you start fusion processes. And you can go through a whole list of different kinds of stars depending on what process is dominant in the interior. In particular, our sun happens to be burning hydrogen, which means we're at the center. Basically, it's fusing hydrogen nuclei to form helium. But as was hinted at, or actually you can look in chapter 12, as was hinted at in the colloquium on Monday, after a certain point, you can't get more energy by fusing things together because the maximum binding energy is sitting out there as you go out at iron. And that has the highest binding energy per nucleon. And so you run out of nuclear energy in these processes, but you've still got gravity there. So other interesting things happen. And where you end up really depends on what the final mass of the system is. And so if the final mass is less than about 1.4 times the mass of the sun, we get what's called a white dwarf. And so the extra source, the thing that's fighting the gravity here, is actually quantum mechanics in the way of the Pauli exclusion principle, which is probably something we haven't done yet. Is it? We've done it. Oh, I see nodding heads. They've done it on that side of the room. In any event, there's some discussion of this in some later chapter in the book. I think it's chapter 24. But the pressure that you get out of the Pauli exclusion principle, well, in this particular case, it starts with the Pauli exclusion principle kicks in first with the lightest set of fermions around, and those are the electrons. And so the electrons set up, and quantum mechanics set up, a certain pressure that can fight against gravity. And that's effective in this particular mass range. But if we're a little bit more massive than that, if we're in the range going up to about twice, these should be wiggles because they're very qualitative. The electrons aren't good enough, or the pressure set up by the degeneracy of the electrons isn't good enough to support the gravitational forces in this mass range. And so what happens is the protons or the pressure increases, it pushes everything closer together, and the new physics kicks in. The protons and the electrons fuse to form neutrons. These are heavier objects. They're still fermions. They're still quantum objects. And so in this particular regime, the same kind of effects kick in again. But now the degeneracy involved, the fermions involved, are neutrons. And so we have a neutron star. The problem, or the The interesting situation, though, that we're most interested in is what happens when we have an end product that has a mass that's even greater than twice the mass of the sun. In this case, there are no known there's no known physics that we know about in nuclear physics, particle physics, that can kick in to prevent or overcome the force of gravity. And so what happens is the gravitational collapse, this object just continues gravitationally collapsing, and we might give it some it's in the book, but it's a particularly bad set of words. So the object collapses. And the final state, then, is a black hole. Now, and we'll figure out precisely what goes under the name black hole. And we'll be talking about that all day, in fact. But the idea is that we can get a handle on this just by thinking about the Schwarzschild geometry. So in the Schwarzschild geometry, that was going to be the geometry in the empty space outside of the star for a spherically symmetric star. I said that the geometry was static, and so what we had in mind, our intuition was that the star itself is static, or it's not changing at all. It turns out that there's a theorem that says that the solution of Einstein's equations, when I've got spherical symmetry, it doesn't matter if the source is changing. As long as I have the spherical symmetry, the geometry outside of that source is going to be the Schwarzschild geometry. So the Schwarzschild As long as we have spherical symmetry, so at some radius that's the size of the star, there's new physics that comes in and reshapes the geometry, i.e., there's all of the matter in the star. But as it's collapsing, what happens is the surface of the star is receding within this approximation. And so what we're doing, or what it's doing, is it's revealing more and more of this space-time geometry. Now, here what I said is that there's nothing going to stop the gravitational collapse. And so it seems then that these interesting places, namely r equals 2m and r equals 0, where things were blowing up and going to 0 in our metric, we have to come to grips with understanding what's going on at those places. So I'll add here as a footnote, this result is something known as Birkhoff's theorem, so that's just a sidelight. But during our collapse, then, of our Schwarzschild space, and so with r equals 2m and r equals 0. So the first thing we can ask is, well, I said that the star is collapsing. We can approximate that or we can ask the question, okay, let's say that it's collapsed and it's revealed the space-time geometry to r equals 2m. And then there's a particle that's following the surface of the star. But I'll delay it by a bit so that this particle is just following a geodesic through the space-time. I can ask, how much time does it take to reach this place, r equals 2m. So we're just going to consider a radially infalling particle or observer. And ask how long so there's the problem, and this is the point where I turn to the audience and ask, so, any suggestions?
Sorry?
I have a question about something different. It was a,
okay.
It was a couple of boards.
A couple of words back.
Or I guess one. So I don't understand how the degeneracy pressure gets overcome. Like that seems like an absolute thing that you wouldn't. Yeah, sure.
How
do you do this?
So he said it's like you didn't. Oh, you're talking about the other case, the neutron star case?
Sure.
Yeah, that's. I was wondering about that too, right? Because he said in the case where you have a white dwarf, and it's collapsing past white dwarf, it's held up by two things, really. The fact that. So pressure, right, is like changing energy over a changing volume, changing energy you take in a changing volume. Your sort of number of particles per volume is constrained by the Pauli exclusion principle, and then your number of particles is constrained. Like, you have to put in energy to reduce the number of particles, so you have to use the electron particles. And then to, yeah, I don't know how it looks in the second case if you collapse or pass the neutron star.
So, one way to think of it.
Is there a simple problem that you've done probably is the infinite well here. And what you know is that there's a certain spacing of the energy levels that, well, if I'm doing, what am I doing? If I'm doing a non-relativistic particle in an infinite square well, the energy levels are going 1 over L squared, where this is L. And so the pressure comes because when I'm pushing on the side, or if I try and shrink L, these energy levels go up, and so the energy is going up. But in that problem, I'm assuming that zero is fixed if there's, at the same time, you know, another thing I can be doing is I can lower the bottom of the well, and in some sense, that's what gravity is doing. And so if the bottom is falling out of the well faster than the energy levels are rising, then the total energy is decreasing. In some sense, there's nothing that's then going to stop you from making this smaller. So qualitatively, that's the kind of picture that you might think of. So this is the quantum mechanics, but gravity plays a role in the picture as well. And that's Chris.
So the way I've always understood it, and just trying to check if this is equivalent, is that you have to move particles to a more excited state in order to obey the exclusion principle, and that you have to excite particles for them to co-occupy.
Right.
And so
but
it's the energy you have to pump in. The pressure comes from the additional energy you have to pump in to get that excited state.
No, it's a, okay, so I went really quickly here. This really isn't
the physics that we want to talk about.
Sorry.
But let's say I have this well. What I'm saying is, let's say there are six electrons in here, and I can put in this particular energy level a spin up and a spin down, spin up and a spin down, spin up and a spin down. And so there's a certain energy. I can't lower the energy and put them all down here. But then the point is that those particular energy levels depend on the size of the system. And so what I was saying was that, well, let's push on the well. Let's try and make L smaller. What happens is that you actually have to raise the energy levels, because the energy levels are going in a non-relativistic problem, or in this particular problem, they're going like 1 over L squared. And so to squeeze the system, I have to raise the energy. It's not that I'm raising, you know, this particle to a new energy level up here. It's just that all of the energy levels get shifted when I change the geometry. One more question.
Like
you did a GGR.
Yeah. If you wanted a clearer idea of how the degeneracy pressure stops the collapse, should you model? Is there some way to model say it's a white dwarf, the whole white dwarf is like a central potential system, and ignore the neutrons.
Yeah, there is actually, and I'll refer you to
chapter 24. I don't know how much he goes into detail, but there are simpler and more complicated. For the white dwarf, I'm not sure to what extent general relativity is really important. I mean, you can do estimates of what the upper bound on the mass is, I think, just using Newtonian gravity. But there, people do detailed studies of, you know, what is that upper mass, or what are these dividing lines? And it's not just the degeneracy of the energy levels. When you have a neutron star, in some sense, you've got a big nucleus sitting there, and people don't really understand completely it goes under the name the nuclear equation of state, or the interactions of those nuclei. And so that becomes important. And in some sense, people think that they might be able to use observations of neutron stars to understand better what the nuclear equation of state is. If you, for example, could clearly say that there's a clear cutoff at two solar masses. So after that diversion, I want to get back to our particle falling through the Schwarzschild geometry. And the question was, how long does it take the particle to get to 2m? And I'm looking for suggestions.
Well, the first question, I think I want to ask your question.
Yeah, is it the particle, or is it?
Let's ask the question this way. I'm saying, how long does it take, but what time am I using to measure how long? So that's the first question we should ask. And so the simplest,
so let's do it both ways. Both ways. Okay, there are two obvious choices. The first is, if I can think of my particle as an observer, he carries clocks with him, and I could ask, what's the proper time that the particle experiences in falling towards r equals 2m? But then I could also be an observer sitting at some fixed radius. In particular, a handy radius is at infinity, where my proper time is now measured by the coordinate time, because the gravitational field has no effect. And so let's try and answer this question in both ways. Let's ask how much proper time elapses and how much coordinate time elapses. So this is just an orbit. It's a particularly simple orbit. And having given that hint, are there any suggestions on how we solve, for example, in the proper time?
ERD tau.
Yes, that is correct. And ERD tau is equal to
E squared minus one.
Well, there you go. So are you reading the book, or are you good?
No, I don't know about this.
Is that not what you said?
I forgot the name.
Okay. So dr by e tau, well, we actually had this effective problem, and what I've done is I've rearranged it, or I didn't even use our effective problem. You can just plug things into the metrics. But dr by e tau, so this comes from the constraint. This equals minus 1, and the other thing that I used was the q by d tau is equal to this constant times 1 over 2m over r. So using both of those, we get to this point, and it's actually a plus and minus that I won't worry about, but I'm infalling, so in principle, I would use the minus sign. And so what I want to do then is I want to know, I'm going to start at some finite radius, fall into r equals 2m, or to some final radius, and I want to know how much proper time elapses. So I just integrate. So I'm going to start at some capital R and go to some r final. And so in principle, we have in mind here taking our final to 2m, r equals 2m. But I just take this, put it in the numerator, put a minus sign in there. And so the first thing, well, this is an integral. We can throw it on the computer. We can evaluate it.
But the comment is that if I stare at this, what happens at r equals 2m? Well, these two factors cancel, but there's nothing in particular that's special happening to the integrand as long as e squared is non-vanishing. And so this integral isn't going to show any divergences. And so even if r final goes to 2m, I'm going to get some finite answer. So those are particle, yeah, okay. No, what was, so there's an effective energy, and it had an e squared minus 1 over 2.
Oh, and that goes.
But this thing we want not to be be equal to 0, otherwise this component would just vanish. Yeah.
Kinetic
energy
is 1. Yeah, so.
Yes.
Give up. No,
well, let's look at that one. Since then, in fact, the integral gets easy. So let's consider e squared equal to 1.
So this would be the guy that you're thinking of who's got the effective energy tuned to 0. But in that case, these two terms just cancel. And my delta tau is equal square root of r dr over square root of 2m. And let's see if I can. So delta tau is just
2/3. Or I can stick an M out here. And then what I've written it as is so that's just an example, but the general property that I wanted to say is that the, you know, as long as we don't do something silly like set E equals 0, which wouldn't be physical, then this answer is a finite answer. But here's an explicit integral that you can do. It's the simplest case when I just choose that to be 1, and then those two terms are canceling. And in fact, there's no real obstruction to evaluating this for smaller values. What if our final was less than 2m? I'd still get some finite answer. So as far as our observer is concerned, then he's going to get, he or she is going to get to places r equals 2m and beyond in a finite amount of elapsed time, according to his clock. But then we can also consider what's happening if I try and record the amount of coordinate time. How much time would pass according to an observer's clock at infinity? So in this case, how many of these? Well, OK. Sorry?
An observer at infinity?
No, but it's, so I've got my grid. So time is just well, we'll see in a moment. It's some label that labels all of the points. It lets me distinguish all of the points. But when I'm saying observer at infinity, what I know is if I go to infinity, then the coordinate time and the proper time coincide.
Oh, because it goes to flat space.
Because it goes to flat space, right? So I should say stationary or static observers who aren't moving around but are just sitting at some fixed r, theta, and phi way out there, they think t is the proper time. So how much coordinate time elapses? I can't quite do the same. Can't quite do the same calculation, but what I can do is using our definition of proper time. It's just the I'm thinking about a time-like interval. The proper time is just minus the line element. I can end up with an equation that looks like 1 minus 2m over r plus dr by dt squared over 1 minus 2m over r is equal to minus d tau by dt squared. You don't have to do it this way. This happens to be a way that I wrote it down here. But then we had this formula that dt by d tau was equal to E over 1 minus 2m over r. And so I can just stick that in there. And what I have then is minus 1 minus 2m over r squared. squared, 1 over e squared.
I've got to ask this stupid question. Just trying to understand, what can we do if
we have dr d tau and dt d tau?
Okay, we can do that one too.
Both of that does work? Okay.
Yeah, you could. I mean, you're saying, I already written down dr by d tau.
Ah, okay. Let's do it that way. So we had dr by d tau was equal to minus e squared minus 1 minus 2m over r 1 half. And all I'm going to do is multiply that whole thing by d tau by dt. But that's precisely this factor that I had over there, 1 minus 2m over r times e. And so I can rewrite that as minus 1 minus 2m over r squared minus 1 over e squared, 1 minus 2m over r cubed, all to the 1 half. And I'm going to do, so this is, that's giving us dr by dt. I'm going to do the same integral, and I'm going to ask, what is delta t? It's going to be then just the integral from our initial position to our final radius, and then dr over that big square root. In this particular, well, okay. Well, let me massage that, just pull out that factor again. So this is the factor that we had before, up to the fact that well, the e squared moved down here, so that's a 1 over e squared now. And as we said before, nothing in particular happens of interest there, but in converting from proper time to coordinate time, we've stuck an extra factor of 1 over 2m minus r in the denominator. And so now when I do this integral, I'm going to end up getting a divergence, a logarithmic divergence, as I approach r equals 2m. And so in my notes, I have, well, let's consider the case e squared equals 1, which simplifies this part or that expression there. And I'll just say that I get my delta t. There's a factor of 2m that I stuck in there. There's a constant term that is just, by which I mean the contribution at capital R, and then I get minus 2/3 R fin over 2m to the 3/2 minus 2 R final over 2m to the 1/2, and then there's a plus log R final over 2m to the 1/2 plus 1 over R final over 2m to the 1/2 minus 1. So this is my, here I see if this is, if the final radius is being taken to 2m, then this denominator is going to 0 and the logarithm is going to diverge. And so as I'm a, as I take the final radius closer to the horizon, or to r equals 2m, what I'm finding is that, well, very explicitly in this expression, I'm getting that log divergence. And again, that's a time, I might associate that time interval with a time interval that an observer looking down at the star and following this object along is observing or measuring as this particle is getting closer and closer to r equals 2m. But remember that the observer himself or the particle falling in only experiences a finite elapsed time. Now, a curiosity is that before, when we had the proper time on the board, there wasn't anything wrong with evaluating it with our final less than 2m. And so I can evaluate this expression as well. And it turns out then that what I'm getting is finite answers again. So in particular then, as I go past, if r final, or r decreases, r final decreases past 2m, then the time is also decreasing. And I'm saying that because it went off to infinity. And given that it's at infinity, it comes back to a finite number. It's decreasing again. And so the question is that really a mathematical curiosity, or does that make sense in some way? And does it really make sense? I mean, the calculation of the coordinate time seemed to make, or not the coordinate time, of the proper time seemed to make sense when I went to values of r equals, or smaller values of r. This one is behaving in a very peculiar way. And so you might ask, does it make sense at all to think about that line element that we had for values of r less than 2m? Yeah.
So the denominator in the logarithm r is less than 2m.
Well, it's now just a finite number. It happens to be a negative number, but it turns out there's an absolute value sitting there. And so, again, as a mathematical expression, I can evaluate that, and I'm getting an answer. So again, there's no, I'm not doing physics there. I'm just saying, here's an expression on the board, and I evaluate it.
But the integrand is diverging at that point, so how can you do the integration passing that point when it has a curve there?
And so what you're saying is, I'm cheating. It looks like, I can evaluate this expression, but it probably doesn't really make sense to do that. And you will return to that point.
I basically had the same.
Okay.
How could, even in principle, the observer talk about observing a particle at r final less than 2m? Because is there any knowledge of just leaving the particle from less than that without the, from right back in?
Okay, so we're getting way ahead. And I'm just, again, I put this on the board as a curiosity, and is there some way to make sense of it? And so survey seems to say that the answer is no. But let's ask the question.
Can we make sense? So forget about that expression for the moment. Can we make sense of the geometry itself? Or the metric? And so we haven't studied yet what Einstein's equations are, but if I restrict myself to values of r less than 2m, then my metric just has some set of functions, or the components are just some well-behaved functions. Again, if I stay away from r equals 0 and r equals 2m, those functions are just finite and they vary. And it turns out that it is is still a solution. But in particular, it's a solution that looks like it has the right to be what we call a space-time, by which I mean it has the appropriate signature. And there what I'm saying is, in this regime, GTT was just minus times 1 minus 2m over r, but that's now a positive number, where GRR, however, is a negative number. And so if I look at my metric, there are still 3 positive eigenvalues and 1 negative eigenvalue. And so what that means is then that locally, the physics that I'm going to observe, you know, for local observers, say that particle that was falling in, the physics that I'm going to observe is still the physics of Minkowski space. It's just the direction that I'm going to associate with the time-like direction is no longer the coordinate t, but rather the coordinate r. So it might be more appropriate then to write the metric and so this looks like time. It's just the time-like direction. And this axis, this is just another space-like direction. And again, that's, well, it's in this regime here. So these are both positive numbers. So that's just the comment. So we have something that looks physical, but we've interchanged sort of what used to be time is now a space-like direction. What used to be r is a time-like direction. And there's some r's sitting here. R squared is a positive number. That just means, well, one interpretation might be then that if this is the direction of time, this component of the metric is now evolving with time. So the spheres are doing some, there's some interesting thing, dynamics in the geometry. To get some better intuition, what I want to do is let's look at the Schwarzschild metric and draw out what the light cone looks like. And so I'm just looking at the RT part of the Schwarzschild geometry, and the light cone is telling me about the directions in which ds squared vanishes. And so I've got I'm just going to draw a picture where that axis is R, that axis is T. Every point in the space has a label R, another label T. There's a special value of R, though, that we noticed already. That's R equals 2m. And of course, there's another special place, which is R equals 0 right there. If I'm going way out here to large values of R, then these factors don't matter. And so I just get the light cone as being directions running at 45 degrees to a point like there. So those would be the null radial vector. There's an outgoing one and an ingoing one. In particular, what I've done is I've said, which way do I want to do it? dr by dt is equal to 1 minus 2m over r squared. No. Well, that was dr by dt squared, was this squared, but I take the square root, and there's a plus and minus. And there's a factor of 1 minus 2m over r. And so the, out at infinity, this term goes away, and I just get dr by dt is plus and minus 1. And so there are these two lines or two directions I can go that run at 45 degrees. As I come in, this kicks in, and it makes this number less than 1. And so what's happening is dr by dt is becoming smaller because I've oriented the axes, so that's R and that's T. What that means is the light cone is getting squeezed. The slope of the lines is becoming steeper and steeper. That was a little bit too dramatic. And so at any point here, say, the light cone directions aren't quite running at 45 degrees. They're now running with a bigger slope. And so if I'm thinking about time-like trajectory, well, the null trajectories are defined by those two arrows. But if I'm thinking about a time-like trajectory, I can wander off in any one of those directions. The point is, though, that it shrinks and shrinks and shrinks, and it shrinks to zero width when I hit R equals 2m. So then the curious thing is, well, there's no real curiosity. I can go through R equals 2m, and I still get answers. There's a sign that flips here. But what happens then is that the time-like direction was R, and so what that's saying is moving towards the future means I'm moving in a fixed direction of R. And so here, again, the slopes are large near R equals 2m, but the light cone is pointed to the side because the evolution now is in the R direction. Yeah.
So when you cross a coordinate singularity point, how do you figure out, if you know which way time was going, like you know like the direction of positive time on one side, how do you figure it out on the other side? Is there like some sort of continuity way to do it or something?
No, because I'm actually cheating. I could have given you the other answer, which is to say that you know, you had to go in the other direction. But
like it seems like
lying to you. Yeah. Yeah. So there are actually two answers here, and a priori there's other physics that went into it to decide which way I'm going. My intuition is that what I'm thinking about is a star that was collapsing, and so the particle that we had was falling a geodesic. It was in falling, and it continued to fall in. Didn't bounce suddenly and come out. And so the part of the space-time that the collapsing star revealed would be one in which time is moving inward in the radial direction. But I think what you're hinting at is there's, if I just think about Schwarzschild geometry by itself, there are going to be other parts of the geometry where, in fact, I could have made another choice, or why, in fact, the other choice is dictated that you're moving towards larger values. Or, but we'll see. We might not get there today.
Okay, but at least it's not like, it shouldn't be like 100% clear that that's the choice you have to make.
No. Okay. And so, again, the intuition I have is that we're thinking about things falling in, so the part of the space-time that I'm interested in is. And then as I'm moving away, just in the same way that the slopes were getting larger and larger, the slopes get smaller and smaller. As I move to r equals zero, in fact, they're collapsing in the same way that they collapse to a single line here. They collapse. I mean, it doesn't really make sense to draw a pop for picture, but they would have collapsed. I'll put a little zero or a circle around that. They would have collapsed down to a single line there as well. But what I said is that
time-like observers or particles following time-like trajectories can pass inside the light cone. And so what you can imagine or what's happening to our infalling particle in the RT plane again is that it's following some trajectory where it's staying everywhere inside the light cone. But to stay inside the light cone, when I draw the picture in the RT plane, the slope has to go to infinity as it approaches r equals 2m. And so that's why the particle wanders off to t, or that's a way to think that why the particle is wandering off to t equals infinity, or why we're getting this logarithmic divergence. So the idea, so the artwork isn't perfect here, but the infalling what we can say is the tangent to that trajectory is always inside the light cone. By which I mean that at each point here, I can draw a light cone, and the tangent vector to that curve is always going to be inside the light cone. And so the slope diverges. As r goes to 2m, and t ran off to infinity. That was the logarithmic divergence. Now, this curious result can be interpreted in the following way. When we looked at the elapsed time, it seemed that it made sense to follow the particle. When I looked at the particle's own proper time, it seemed to make sense to follow the particle past r equals 2m. And so there must be a line that I can draw on the board here to say where the particle is when the values of r are less than 2m. And it turns out that the trajectory that the particle's following is now again inside the light cone everywhere, but it's moving from t equals plus infinity down to finite values of t and eventually it crashes into R equals zero. So the integral that I did wasn't quite giving, well, it turns out that it would give us this line, but the way I interpreted it wasn't quite, the physical interpretation we were giving that integral really only made sense out here. Namely, it makes sense, or well, it was sensible up to this point to say what was the clock out at infinity saying when the observer was at the different values of the radius. That interpretation doesn't really make sense after I've passed this event horizon. The only other comment is that these trajectories are again inside the local light cone. So this is a picture I can draw, but of course we had the singularity in our integral. Things are going off to infinity and then coming back to sensible values of time. Clearly this isn't a good set of coordinates, or this isn't a very intuitive picture to draw. And so what we'd like to do is we'd like to find a better coordinate system or a better set of pictures to draw so that we can have a more physical picture as to what's happening, or a more intuitive picture as to what's happening in the space-time geometry. Did you have a question, or no? Okay.
So we've chosen to study the metric in a very special coordinate system, but that coordinate system has problems at R equals 2m. So what we'd like to do is find better coordinates, and at this point, the book presents, as manna from the gods, the Eddington people scene. Coordinates, and in brackets over here, I will write in calling. And so we just write the formula here. So what we're going to do is replace t with a coordinate v equals t plus r plus 2m along and so I wanted to give you a little bit more practical or intuitive picture as to where this comes from. And so what I'm going to do is say, let's go back to our line element. And then there's the zero part. But the interesting part is really this part of the metric, because that's where things are being problematic at R equals 2m. Now, here I have something going to zero. That doesn't seem so bad and really shouldn't be so intimidating, in that we've written down lots of metrics before. You have, namely, for example, polar coordinates where things go to zero every now and then. And so this is something that we should be able to handle. The real problem is this one, where one of our components of the metric is diverging. And so our goal is to get rid of this one, the thing that's going to infinity. So I'll say this is not so bad. But I want to get rid of this divergent term. And so having made that our goal, a simple thing that I can say is, well, let's try and replace the time coordinate with a new coordinate. That has some R stuff on it, because when I do that coordinate transformation, what's going to happen is I'm going to feed more stuff into dr squared, and so by tuning things appropriately, I can get rid of this divergent contribution. And so all we do, or all one has to do then, is expand
And so what I would like is I would like F to behave in such a way that this number, instead of diverging, is just some finite number. The choice that we're making here, it turns out, is the simplest number to choose is just to set this equal to 0 when R equals 2m. And so a simple way to do that is set it to 0 everywhere. So this actually allows us a lot of freedom, but a simple choice is just to set it to 0 everywhere, because then I've gotten rid of the divergence, certainly. And so if I want to set that to 0, it turns out, well, F squared is equal to 1 minus 2m over r squared, and so f is equal to plus or minus 2m. The other constraint is I don't just want this to be finite everywhere. I want to make sure that I don't introduce any divergences there. I introduced an f that had a divergence in it. It had to get rid of this, but I can check there that that component isn't going to have any bad behavior at 1 minus 2m over r by just plugging everything back in. What I have is minus 1 minus 2m. And then the sphere part of the metric. And so we're still stuck with something going to 0, but this part is finite. One thing that I'll say right away is I had a choice to make here. There's a plus or minus sign, and so there are actually two different values or two different choices I could have made for v, and I'll give them names. Rather than plus and minus, I'll call them minus and plus. So V minus I'm going to associate with the choice plus here. V plus I'm associating with the choice minus here. But then the thing I wanted to assure you is that this really isn't so bad at R equals 2m. This term goes away, and I'm just left with plus other finite stuff on the sphere. And the thing is that while that may look curious, it might be reminiscent of something you've run into. In flat space or in Minkowski space, it's sometimes convenient, rather than using ordinary Schwarzschild coordinates in certain problems, you might want to use coordinates which, say, are the linear combinations t plus x and t minus x. And in that case, our usual Minkowski metric just reduces down to minus du dv plus dy squared plus dz squared. So this is just a coordinate transformation on Minkowski space. But with that choice, the line element has this curious off-diagonal form of one coordinate times the other. But that's precisely the kind of form that we're finding here. And so that's just to reassure you that having a metric like this, where this goes to 0, and so rather than having 4 entries, I only have 2 entries now, is not so bad. We'll go back to the choice. What I implicitly had was this, or alternatively, dv So the reason I did that is because I want to match the plus in this form. I want to match the plus minus subscript here with the plus minus on the dr. And this is something that I can just integrate. And so the coordinate system that's presented in the book, then, is just one of the choices Hartle chooses, or Hartle focuses on. V plus. So that's the coordinate he's calling V. And it corresponds to, Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates, but it's a particular set. It sometimes has the extra label infalling Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates. But let's get some intuition for this new metric by, again, thinking about where is the light cone. And again, just for radial motion, before we had it in the TR plane, now we're working in the VR plane, by which I mean V plus. So I'm going to, just like Hartle makes one choice here, we're going to follow through just with V plus. And so we're saying we want the null directions for this metric. And so one of the solutions to that equation is that I should only move in V and I should fix R. No, this, I did that the wrong way. Or the other choice it just comes from setting, dividing out by the factor of dV. And then I have to move in R and V simultaneously, but I have to set dr equals 1/2 1 minus 2m over R dV. And so if I'm thinking of moving forward in the V coordinate, there's a curious thing that happens here in that this is positive when I'm out at large values of R. So this is a positive coefficient. If that's bigger than 2m, and I'm also thinking of dV as being positive. So I can move along the light cone. I'm moving positive in dr and in dV at the same time. But if I go to r less than 2m, if I'm moving forward in dV, I now have to be moving towards smaller values of r. And so we want to draw a similar picture to what we had before. Although, in fact, it's traditional not to draw the picture with the coordinate axes running at 45 or at right angles. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to let R, so lines of constant R are going to be vertical lines the same way they were before. But because of this fact here that V, or a line of fixed V, is always a null line, I'm using that as motivation to draw lines of constant V at 45 degrees. So that'll help guide our intuition as to what the picture is telling us. So this is so I might have a coordinate grid then that, so that, that's just, well, this is just a picture to guide our intuition, and so this is the way that I want to draw the picture. So if I'm following one of these lines, one thing I can say right away is, so this is V equals a constant. And so one leg of the light cone for any point along that line is going to be pointing along our V equals constant line. So that's this leg of the light cone. I should have drawn our special. So this is R equals 2m. This is R equals 0. If I'm sitting out here at larger values are greater than 2m, what we said is the other leg of the light cone is given by moving both forward in V. So implicitly that means from one line here forward out in that direction, and also to larger values of R. So the other leg of the light cone then points out something like that. However, that slope, or that coefficient, is getting smaller and smaller, and so the displacement at R is getting smaller, or the slopes well, the slope moves to zero here, and I'm supposed to draw some transition. Ah. So those are our light cones. And then they flipped over inside r equals 2m. Well, at r equals 0 or r equals 2m, I'm not moving in r at all. I'm just following a vertical line. But then inside, I'm moving in negative directions. And so that leg of the light cone has tipped over. So one leg of the light cone is always along that line, and the other leg of the light cone starts pointing out here, and it comes up to the vertical, and then keeps continuing to tip over as I move inside r equals 2m. So there are lots of comments. So so here the So out here, again, the outer leg points to larger values of r. At r equals 2m, the outer leg is vertical. Whereas here inside, the outer leg what's the question?
The other axes, one of your axes is r. What's the other axes? What are we in?
This is...
So my grid is... this is r, but what I mean by that is vertical lines like this are lines of r equals a constant. This is r equals 0, r equals m, r equals 2m, 3m, etc. Then what I said is because v equals, or not, if I move around on a surface of constant v, that's a null direction. Our intuition in Minkowski space is null directions are supposed to point at 45 degrees. And so I'm guiding that intuition by saying, let's draw the lines of constant v at 45 degrees. So this is, you know, v equals 1. 2, 3, 4, 5. So those are, if you want me to put a line, that's moving towards larger values of v, but the point is each one of those lines is a line of constant v. Yeah. And then, what was the other thing we had? Oh, the other thing we had was that we thought about the infalling particle or geodesics. And again, a geodesic or a time-like geodesic is sitting locally everywhere inside the light cone. But what I can see is that there's nothing nothing very dramatic happening at this surface r equals 2m. I don't have to run off to infinity. I'm not running into a divergence. I just arrive here at r equals 2m at some finite value of v, and then I continue on to other finite values of v. So there's no coordinate divergence as the geodesic. And if you go back one page and look at the coordinate transformation, you can see why that is, because explicitly v equals t plus some stuff, but that stuff had a logarithmic term. And so that logarithm is precisely canceling the logarithmic divergence that we saw before. And so the values of v that we end up here are finite. But clearly what that's saying is this is a better coordinate system to use in describing the transition as the particle follows or crosses that surface r equals 2m. Something that I didn't say before, but I'll say now, is we're always moving towards smaller values of r once I'm inside the surface r equals 2m. But in particular, that means that if I am an observer and I'm telling the person at infinity what my experiences are or what the results of some experiment are, at some point I cross r equals 2m and I'll never be able to send signals outward because the light cone is tipped over. And all of the time-like or light-like geodesics or curves are pointing towards smaller values of r. And so we'll never be able to ourselves cross back over without following a space-like geodesic. But time-like geodesics inevitably end up at r equals 0. And similarly, any signals, signals traveling at the speed of light also inevitably end up at r equals 0. Of course, we saw that before. Time was pushing us towards smaller and smaller values of r, and the light cone was pointed sideways. But I'm just emphasizing it here. So we can't escape whatever's happening here at r equals 0. One of the things to note is that in our coordinate system, which is nice here at r equals 2m, it still has a problem at r equals 0. It's diverging. One might wonder, is this another problem with coordinates? But in fact, this time, there's a real problem with the space-time geometry. And this is actually a singularity, or a real divergence. So I'll say the words, there's a divergence in the curvature or the gravitation, the cavitate, or the space-time geometry really has a problem there. One way to get a sense of that is that what we said is these lines of constant v are just null, null lines. So I can imagine if I'm an observer here that I send in a signal at v equals, well, v equals zero. And I can send in a signal a short time later at some delta v. This is cheating slightly, but if I consider the displacement or the separation, what I said is that the separation was just some finite amount of time or some finite distance here. But what you find is that that separation is, well, it's given by precisely GVV. So the separation between these two lines, even though they look like they're parallel lines on this picture, the proper separation there is actually diverging as I approach r equals zero. And so that's, well, that's what this divergence is. And so that's an indication or a hint that there's something really physically problematic about the space-time geometry at that point.
Well, that's it, yeah. What else? Let's get that. So, the last 10 minutes, what I'm going to do is I'll do another coordinate transformation just for fun, and then we'll talk next day about really more of the physics as to what's going on in the space-time. So a slightly more complicated coordinate transformation is the following.
This is going to something called Kruskal coordinates. So these are coordinates that are useful to really get a feel or a picture for the entire space-time. There's an interesting story there in that Martin Kruskal was a mathematician at Princeton. He thought that was just, well, it's a coordinate transformation, it's trivial. How could that be of any interest? But John Wheeler, who at the time was a physicist at Princeton and found it extremely useful to understand the space-time geometry in this coordinate system, insisted that a coordinate system, that just doing a coordinate transformation was not trivial. And even though this person refused to publish it because it was trivial, John actually wrote up the paper for him and sent it off to Physics Letters B. And that's why people know about this coordinate transformation. In any event, what we're doing now is we're going to replace not just t, but r and t and the new coordinates that we're going to choose are called u and v. And there's a complicated formula that I have to write down. So u, v, they both start with r on 2m minus 1 to the 1 half. this is actually something I'm going to do, or I'm going to interpret for the region R greater than 2m. In the region R less than 2m, we just change the formulas slightly. To avoid imaginary numbers here, we have to turn that around. We have the same exponentials. And we have to flip the hyperbolic sinh and cosh. So that's a definition that I'm going to use for these small values. And in this case, I'll just say one does a lot of algebra, and at the end of the day, becomes the following. There is ds squared equals 2m cubed over r e to the minus So the claim is that I can apply that coordinate transformation to the metric or the line element that we had before, and we end up with this result. It may be somewhat disconcerting that R here appears, but I can just think of R as a function of U and V. In particular, what we have here are these hyperbolic cosh or cosine and sine. And so we can use the identity that cosh squared minus sinh squared is equal to 1. And so it turns out then if I take u squared minus v squared, I get an expression that only depends on r. And so implicitly, this equation defines what R is in terms of these two coordinates. And so when I think of R here, I think of that as just some function of these two variables. And you can also see from this that, well, before I was drawing these nice vertical lines in all of our pictures, but in terms of a UV plane, R, a fixed value of R defines some kind of a hyperbola. So in particular, for R equals 2m, what I have is u squared minus v squared equals 0. So that's actually the degenerate case where I have two lines at 45 degrees. But R equals 0, which is the place that we said was problematic, is just going to be u squared minus v squared equals minus 1. Uh, okay. Before we start drawing pictures, the other thing I can do, because the prefactors here, depending on R, are the same in both expressions, what I can do is I can take the ratio to get rid of the R's, and then I can see what T is implicitly in terms of U and V. And so what I can do is, so the sinh over the cosh is a tanh T over 4M. And in that particular region, that gives me capital V over capital U. But I've switched the order there, and so I get U over V. So if we take the pictures that we had before and we try and draw a picture in the UV coordinates, V looks like, well, it is a time-like coordinate everywhere, and so it's natural, I'll pick my vertical axis to be V. The spatial direction I'll choose to be U, or, well, spatial, the horizontal axis I'll choose to be U. What I said was that at R equals 0, I get just a hyperbola in this plane. Well, now let's start with the lines at 45 degrees. So that's the line U equals minus V. This is U equals V. The hyperbola sits inside here. So that's R equals 0. And again, this is the place we think there's a singularity.
Where is R equals 2m?
Okay, that's what. This is R equals 2m. R equals 2m is U squared minus V squared equals 0. So it gave me those two lines at 45 degrees.
Sorry, I just got
it OK. But what you can also ask is, that's a line of R equals 2m. What are the lines, well, OK, what are the lines of T doing? So at t equals 0, say, I can look at that equation, and what I have is just v equals 0, because the tanh is 0. So this would be the t equals 0 surface. As I adjust t, or as t evolves, what I get are, well, that defines the slope of some line in the, a straight line in the UV plane. And so lines of constant t so are just straight lines like this. One of the interesting things that happens is, as so this is t equals 0, as I follow t equals to plus infinity, the tanh function just goes to 1. And so that's, again, the line u equals v. So this line is both r equals 2m and t equals plus infinity. But that might be a reminder of what we saw before. What I said is that these geodesics that we were drawing in the RT plane, when they went over to the line, the surface r equals 2m, they naturally were driven off to t equals infinity. So here, that's illustrating, or it's supposed to illustrate that was just a coordinate problem. Similarly, if I go to t equals minus infinity, I end up, the tanh goes to minus 1, and I end up on that line down there. But that's also true over here. This part of the line is also r equals 2m, t equals minus infinity. And what I, well, I guess what I should have said is, in this region, this is the region of r less than 2m. The constant t slice lines are still just straight lines with a given slope in the UV plane. And so what happens is that, again, you get lines like this being t equals a constant. And in fact, t equals 0 just ends up being a vertical line in that region. So maybe, no, I shouldn't. So I've drawn a lot of lines. Well, I've drawn two particular surfaces for fixed r. I've drawn a lot of lines of constant t. And I'll remind you that the lines of constant r were just these hyperboloid. And so there are other surfaces of r equals a constant that run through the picture like this. And similarly, outside, however, they're the sign is changing, and so the hyperboloid sits outside like that. Yeah? Oh, dear. Should it always be positive? In the region r greater than 2m, I define it with a cosh. And so what I said is it's always, what you're saying is it's always positive, but that's, again, this region. Okay. Right? So just, there's too many lines. So there's a line r equals 2m. I'll draw r greater than 2m. That's this part of the space. That's this quadrant of the UV plane. There's a line r equals 2m that cuts out that wedge. There's r equals 0 here. And so I'll put a label r less than 2m. And so that's this quadrant of the space. And it's cut off by the singularity, or by the hyperboloid that's r equals 0.
Below the diagonal u equal minus v is not covered.
That's an interesting question, which, if I'm thinking about stars, the answer is that wouldn't be part of the geometry, because what I would have had is a star, you know, I would have started down here, the star would have had a size r and a time t, would have followed some geodesic. Or no, it wouldn't have followed some geodesic. It would have followed some time-like curve and ended up on r equals 0. But all of this part of the geometry inside the star wouldn't have been covered by Schwarzschild space, or by the Schwarzschild geometry. I'm hesitant to draw that on the picture because it's already too messy, but I'll say it again. If we had been thinking about a collapsing star, which is how I motivated the whole lecture, there'd be some surface here, which Bruno is going to force me to draw. So there's some time-like trajectory, which would have been the surface of the star as it's collapsing. And what I know is that as it's collapsing, the stuff outside, the space-time outside of the star, larger values of r, that is given by the Schwarzschild geometry, because we, as long as it's spherical collapse, we have the spherical. So that part of the space-time was Schwarzschild geometry. But the stuff inside the star, the space-time inside the star, which I'd have to solve Einstein's equation, and the geometry would be different. However, one might just say, well, given the Schwarzschild geometry, here it is. Just let's think of it as in space-time, as a solution of Einstein's equation, so there's some mathematical space there. And what Bruno pointed out is I've only covered the plane up to this line here. What happened in this region of the space?
And we luckily run out of time, and I, well, it'd be easy to draw. It turns out, you know, you could follow geodesics backwards. So you could see that if I was sitting here, I could reach out there. I'd have to move forward in time, but I could move from here to here in a finite time interval. And so you could ask the same question, well, what if I, what was I doing before, you know, my clock read tau equals zero here? And so it's easy to extend the geodesic trajectories into this region of the space. And it turns out that, in fact, you get an inverted copy of the geometry living down here. Similarly, if I was sitting up here, I could ask, you know, the same question. Can I follow the trajectories past this line? And the interesting thing is, in this region, you get another copy of this space-time. And so you get a, well, then you would fill out the entire picture with, in fact, the inside of the black hole here, an inverted geometry or a white hole here, and then you actually have two asymptotic regions on either side. Meaning that if I headed off in this direction out to infinity, I'd get the flat Minkowski space again. But maybe we can draw some pictures and say those words again next day when we talk a little bit more about the geometry. Are there any
other problems? Does this white hole business have anything to do with physics?
Not at this lecture. And then I'll go to lunch. We can talk about it at lunch.
So if you interpret the charts into Cartesian coordinates, would you get like a chart that covers? Would you get a chart whose domain is all of R4 except the line at pi? Are you realistic? Would you get a chart whose domain is all of R4 except the line at the like the time axis and whose range is the entire Schwarzschild space time?
Say that again. You want to find.
Okay. I take the chart. I change it to like Cartesian coordinates using the standard change variables. Do I then get a chart whose domain is all of R4 except the time axis, and whose range is the entire space time?
I'm not sure what you mean when you say you're changing the current.
Like, so the I think the Finkelstein. Oh, I guess it doesn't look like. Okay.
I mean, there was a question I had in my notes, which I didn't ask, but. You know, if you're, I mean, what I did is I said, let's fool around with the Schwarzschild line element. And I came up with some coordinate change that says dt equals, you know, dd plus or minus dr over 1 minus dm over r. A question I could have asked is, well, where did it be convenient to, you know, we had this problem that something was disappearing at, you know, DVD was disappearing at r equals 2m, so wouldn't it have been convenient to write square root of, you know, to gather up GTT into our coordinate transformation? And then the question becomes, well, why didn't I do that? Why would I not do this? Why would I not write that equation on the board? Other than to ask a question, which is, why does that not make any sense?
You've reintroduced the singularity you were hoping to.
That is correct. If you do the algebra in your head, you reintroduce the singularity. But there's something more fundamental, which is that this is not a this doesn't define a coordinate transformation. The thing is that is a coordinate transformation. The reason I know that is that I can integrate it, and we did. You know, we had dt integrates to t, b integrates to b, and then there's some function of r here that integrates to some function of r. But if I write something like this now, or, you know, I could have put it down here, this isn't something I know how to integrate. R and b, as far as this expression are concerned, are independent variables. So I can't integrate an expression like that. And so this isn't defining a legitimate coordinate transformation, whereas that is, because what I'm multiplying the dr by is just a function of r, so that I can integrate. I'll pause there. Does that make sense?
I don't know if that is related to my question. So my question was, so specifically what I want to do is do the change of coordinates, x equals r squared sine theta, or whatever. Let's derivative theta, and we just do x equals r sine of v, y equals r cosine of v. And then that gets rid of r and v, and now we have a metric in terms of v, x, and y.
What I would have said is that you'd end up with a different metric. It would be a very messy metric. It wouldn't be something that you would recognize as flat space. But at the end of the day, I know all you're doing is, what distinguishes the infalling coordinates is that they actually cover this part of the space, the part that I've drawn in here. And so doing a coordinate transformation isn't going to change that. You can push coordinate singularities around. I guess doing a coordinate transformation, what you can do is you can change how much of the slope space time you cover, but you're not going to change the geometry itself. So this isn't answering your question, but let me say something else. I said that there was another set of coordinates, namely if I chose the minus sign, those are called outgoing editing frequency coordinates. In fact, what they would cover would be this region of the space-time, and then the stuff that's hidden back here behind this surface, u equals minus v. By studying those coordinates, that's giving you a hint that there is a piece of Schwarzschild space-time that lives back here. But again, that's treating it as sort of an interesting mathematical space-time in and of itself. If I have stars floating around, then that part of the geometry gets cut off. So I didn't answer your question, but... was there another question there? If not, I'm happy to talk with Aaron afterwards. Yeah. Why don't we all go to lunch?
Just before we end, there are loads of freebies out there that Debbie's now going to be distributing t-shirts.